You contact power heads, you contact global leaders, you contact high military people that have a lot of power, you contact perhaps even what controls money, seen and unseen on this globe, to make a difference. And that's proper protocol. I think they knew it wouldn't work, but no one can say, hey, we didn't do the right thing first. Clearly, I've had many abductions that involve military. I've seen officers. I've seen military sort of police or security. I've interacted with these people. I've talked with these people face-to-face during these abductions. And in that particular scenario in the hangar, I couldn't have been any more dead awake conscious. That abduction was primarily, I would say, 90 to 95% human-oriented. Fortunately, nature dictates that time is resilient. It's like a rubber band. It wants to bounce right back to where it was. Not to say it cannot be manipulated, but it takes the cooperation of a lot of different entities, a lot of different groups, a lot of different species.
Experience that there is.
Sure.
It's almost a strange cosmic humor. I don't know. I mean, is that
it's
what you
cynical.
Felt at times?
It's a cynical sense of humor, okay? It's taken me years to see that there is a certain degree of emotion. It's as conscious as you and I are speaking right now and as I'm seeing the coffee table in front of me. Yeah, it's hard, hard physical stuff. When I say guy, E.T., he was there, as you say, on a suggestive or advisory capacity in that particular project, and it was fast and it was going to be quick. And why I was there, I don't know. But I've been a part of this stuff for 19 years. But they had extra security, meaning that they had these jets scrambling over to the spot, flying by the side of the hangar, over the hangar, because you can hear the sounds. And then, of course, they had these what looked like military police or security 20 feet apart from each other, all the way around the interior of this hangar. There is a growing majority, in my experience, in Black Ops. There's a growing majority in agencies, sanctioned and not sanctioned, secret governments, call it whatever you want. There's a growing majority that realizes that they want to get this stuff out, and there's no avenue. Now, once these things are out, then the face of the planet as we see it will not be the same. For the first time in human history, we can evolve. And we can evolve to the point of joining the galactic neighborhood. But that avenue has to be created first.
So
that's
Jim. Outrageous, Jim.
Yeah, that's it. You should. Time for a lawsuit to get it back.
Yeah, who would do such a thing?
Okay. I know a lot of people go through some of the basics with you, but all the interviews I've heard have gone through a lot of that, and we've got a few more questions that go into a bit more depth, and I hope you're okay. If we give this a context on the radio show ourselves and on the website, then we thought that we could just skip some of the intro
Absolutely.
Stuff.
Absolutely.
Excellent.
In general, when it's I break it in three parts, but we'll bypass all that. The first 6 years of not knowing what's going on, the second 6 or 7 years is seeing an agenda and learning, and the last 6 years has been where it's evolved. But we can bypass all that stuff. Go to the questions, and I'll go right into them for you.
Okay.
Always remember that we can, if you ever want to go into the future with this, it's necessary. You got my full cooperation. So if we can't get enough.
I think you may regret that, Jim, with the amount of questions we've got.
Did I say that? No, I didn't say that.
Well, the thing is,
I never mentioned that.
It's interesting because we've got like a whole, I mean, we sat down last week and we've got a whole stack of questions on the language issue alone. I mean, I don't know how much depth you want to go into in that, but we found that fascinating. And so I don't know if we could skip about those sort of now.
It is phenomenal, actually. It is, and I'm seeing it in a broader view and a deeper understanding as time goes on. So it's multifaceted.
God,
which is what we were really sort of wanting to talk to you about. I mean, to be honest, we think that deserves a whole program of its own, because if you've had new insights as well, then that would be an amazing thing to talk about. Just that topic completely.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, sure. I agree with you. It is something of its own.
Also, just the fact, Jim, I mean, just mention this briefly, that for years we've known about, you may know this, but there are tribes all around the world. There are so-called prehistoric and so-called primitive tribes that actually use, in trance states, using drumming or other methods, they use a very similar system of symbols and language that basically they transmit to each other into one another's sort of mind's eye. These symbols appear visually, and these people communicate in these ways. These are tribes from the Amazon Basin and all sorts of things, and also tribes from Africa. I think some of the Aborigines had some of this going on as well. So there's huge links there to the whole sort of shamanistic and the tribes from the Amazon and all sorts of things going on. So there's lots of connections there as well with just what's going on, just on an evolutionary level with regards to this thing, you know.
It makes sense to me, because if you can put 20 pages of text in a symbolic form and then read the whole thing within, you know, a nanosecond or a second, and that's one intricate part of what this is about. Even in telepathic, are we in the interview? Shall I continue or what?
Okay,
you guys have the emotive. You guys go on your agenda, so I'm listening.
Yeah, we've gone off the question. Okay. All right, we've gone off the questions already. Let's start. Okay.
Okay, David.
All right. Okay, so welcome to Cosmic Trigger Radio for Exopolitics UK. We're very pleased to have Jim Sparks on with us. I've done a review on Amazon UK for Jim's book, but actually, if you want to visit Jim's website, it's jim-sparks.com, and you can have a look around there, and you can actually purchase his book from there, and well worth a read, and certainly the thing that gave us the impetus to perhaps want to have a chat to Jim in the first place.
Right, I want to talk about chapter one in the book, first of all, and
okay.
You've labelled Abducted by the Mafia, and really just to talk about something that a lot of ufologists and exopolitics theorists don't really go into, and that's the high weirdness aspect of it. Now, I'm not going to be able to give it justice in the way you explain the incident, so if you could just go ahead and let our listeners
sure.
know what the first incident was about.
Well, that was an abduction scenario that I say there's two ways to go generally. The easy way is when a craft is on the ground and they come in and they escort you out of your home. High technology takes place when you walk through walls. They can do that with matter, just technology. The hard way is when the craft is in the air and it pulls you from point A to point B while it's in flight. In that case, there was a series of things going on. I was well into the, I guess it's off the top of my head, seventh or eighth year of abduction. When I was laying on the bed and I felt something shaking my foot, what I saw was a gray, and he was in clothes that looked like that, for lack of a better description, that of the 40s, 50s. era when they wore suits like that in the Mafia. So that's how that title came. He also screen imaged his face to make it look more human-like. So what I got out of just that peculiarity right there was the fact that these guys travel time. They have that technology. It's like using a remote control. They can go back and forth in time. They see different fashions. They see different styles. They see different types of clothing. And they can be in the 40s, they can be in the 30s, and they can be even in the future, well into 2100 or above. And I think there may be a interaction with people of that time. There may have been some kind of a almost an intimate contact, so to speak, where they picked up on the fashion of that day to make the abductee more comfortable. So when that particular gray came to escort me to the craft, he was wearing something of a day of the 40s or so to maybe make me feel, is what I picked up, more comfortable with his presence.
Sure. I mean, it's that whole aspect, and I think you mentioned it, didn't it? That sense of high weirdness and are they actually laughing, you know, on the craft about this? And it's, you know, it really reminded me of another incident that took place in 1962. I mean, it's not that well known. It's Joe Simpton, and a craft landed. He was on his farm. Some entities got out and gave him 4 pancakes. And it was just such a wonderfully, you know, I just love that aspect of the whole, you know, the whole experience that there is.
Sure.
It's almost a strange cosmic humor. I don't know. I mean, is that
it's
what you felt at times?
It's a cynical sense of humor, okay? It's taken me years to see that there is a certain degree of emotion. Definitely the first, I've been at this has been going on for 19 years. And
sure.
You could have asked me almost any given time a few years ago, do they have feelings? And I would just say, no,
yeah.
None whatsoever. But I'm seeing something here over a longer term now that there appears to be, if emotion can be called a sense of humor, that there is a, in rare cases, in some instances, but I spot it, and you can't help it, there's a cynical, sort of a cynical sense of humor.
Have you had any other incidents along those lines, or was that the
yeah,
strange?
I had one that was really, you know, you're getting into depth right away, and usually I lead into this stuff, but I guess I have the credibility behind me to know that I'm
sure.
Speaking off the cuff. But there was one incident that was definitely showed a cynical sense of humor. During the course of all these 19 years, it was based always on punishment and reward in the early years to get me to cooperate or to get the subject to cooperate. But as the years went on, if I did well in any project and an abduction, whether it's to learn a symbol or whatever they were teaching, there would always be a reward session where I could either ask a question or perhaps play with some of the technical gizmos, so to speak, on board. And one session I did very, very well, and so now I was going to ask a scientific question, and hopefully I could get an answer. Well, I said, my question was, what is faster than the speed of light? I thought that was pretty good.
Yeah, that's a very valid question.
Right? So a hologram comes up, and it's not uncommon for, it looks like a hologram to respond to a question so you can see an image imagery. And here's where the sense of humor came in, which at first it wasn't funny to me at all, but later I laugh about it now. It showed my face, and it showed a musket rifle, two musket rifles, pointing to both sides of my head. And I would say the musket rifles were from the 1700s.
Wow.
And the firing pin had just went off where it makes the spark. And a musket ball was coming out of both ends of the barrel, both at the same time towards the direction of my head. Now, that was meant to be funny, so maybe your mind is faster or you know, whatever it was supposed to be, it was funny. And it was like the most comical thing in the 19 years that I'd ever seen. Now, at the time, the interaction had not evolved to where it is in these last few years, and so I was extremely guarded. I was still angry at them, and I was extremely suspicious of their motives. So at the time, I went, what kind of stupid answer is that? You know, it kind of upset me. But over the years, I realized it was just, it's not uncommon for them to answer in riddles and to be ambiguous. And I see it now as they were just being funny.
Sure. Yeah, sure. That's wonderful.
Yeah, I can see that picture.
It really seems that that's the nature of the phenomena, doesn't it? This ambiguity, riddles, metaphor. It's a very kind of sophisticated form of communication. I mean, that's without the whole language thing. I mean, on a general level, I would really be interested to speak more about the whole concept of screen imaging, because you pretty much picked up very early on that it was a technology, in the sense that I think initially, if I'm right, that they projected that we were, you know, good angels or bad demons, and you of very early saw through that. And I just wonder what gave it away. What was it, an intuition that this was?
Oh, sure. Should I respond to the tail end of the last, what we just talked about, and
sure.
I'll go right into that. The problem with the main reason that I can see why they don't directly like to answer questions is because, let's bear in mind, in my experience, we've got beings that think 10 to 100 times faster. We got beings that, have been around tens of thousands of years, if not longer. The lifespan is extremely long. They've abducted, even individually, if you look at each grade, in the abduction scenario, they've probably abducted hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. And it's always the same questions we have. We can't help ourselves. The first thing we're going to go, who are you? Where are you from? Why are you here? And so after hearing those same questions over thousands of years, you can kind of see why they respond in a cynical, ambiguous, and answer in riddles way. In response to me shaking it off right away, I was extremely hateful. I was extremely angry. The problem with human beings is after 6 or 8 or 10 seconds, the focus factor on us, we drift all over the map. That's just the way we are. They stay focused on one thing so strong. My focus was anger, hate, and so I was able to concentrate and maintain a level of concentration through my anger and my hate, and maintain it in a focal point that would go on for several minutes at a time on something that had just taken place. And I think it made it easier for them to communicate with me, because now they had, so to speak, a chimpanzee, and I don't mean to belittle us, but that isn't changing his thoughts every 6 seconds. And what really tuned me into them in the that made me realize that they were screen imaging was, it was a verbal thing. It was telepathic. They didn't create an image. It was a metaphor that I picked up right away, and I said, hey, man, these guys do things, and here's what I mean. I was extremely angry in one session. I was yelling, I was screaming, I would make up cuss words for these guys. I didn't know why I was there in those early years, in the late 80s. I had no clue what they were doing, and they weren't telling me. I just thought it was more like torture. And one session, I was just really beside myself with anger and out of control, even though they then paralyzed my vocal cords. I was still obstinate. I wasn't going to cooperate. And so one of them walked up, and he looked at my face, and he telepathically said, your behavior is not pleasing to God. Okay. So I got even madder, because I said, no way on earth are you guys, you know, connected to God. Okay. And then another try was, we're demons, we're devils, okay? And I said, oh, yeah, you're demons and you're devils, and you fly around in a UFO and you use technology. So that set a foundation for me, that abductions ever since then, that whatever they were trying to bring, they take the path of least resistance. Whatever subdues you, if it's fear, if it's or if you think it's angelic, or if you think it's sexual, or if you think you're with the hottest girlfriend that you could ever have in your life, or whatever it may be, they throw these images in your mind, and I learned that, whoa, this is not reality, and you can do it, anybody can do it, you shake it off, and then you see it for what it is.
We're back now with part two of the Jim Sparks interview. Jim's authored a book called The Keepers. If you want to order that book, you can go direct to his website, which is jim-sparks.com. Sure. Jim, it's David again. I think what's interesting, obviously, there seems to be this prankster-like element with regard to the screen imaging process. I think what I'm interested in, what a lot of other people would ask at this situation, and perhaps you could reference this with regard to the time that you found yourself in the military base, and how did you decide, or how do people in this situation decide if there's this degree of screening imaging going on that's obviously related to the consciousness of the person at the time, then how, when you described in Nevada in the military base, the fact that you were seeing at some point they were soldiers and at some point they turned to perhaps the classic grey formation, how did you put some sort of objectivity onto the situation to know perhaps what was actually going on, to get a grip on the situation, or perhaps didn't that ever happen? Is it still to an extent float? Obviously you've come out with a story and a narrative from this, so how have you decided what's real and what isn't to an extent?
That was absolutely not foggy. Clearly, in those scenarios, I'm as dead conscious as you and I are communicating via telephone for this interview. When screen imaging is in place, it's under scenarios that you can kind of, conditions that you can see how they can take advantage of it, considering your state. Clearly, I've had many abductions that involve military. I've seen officers, I've seen military sort of police or security. I've interacted with these people, I've talked with these people face to face during these abductions, and in that particular scenario in the hangar, I couldn't have been any more dead awake conscious. That abduction was primarily, I would say, 90 to 95% human oriented. The only thing that made it an alien thing was the fact that they were working on something in that hangar. Not knowing exactly, but what I could see, they were working on something that I would say is almost like a teleport system.
Sure.
They had people in these canisters, and it was almost as if they somehow transported or wired them from their homes, not across space or anything. Clearly, I was looking at everything. I was awe-bound by the fact that I was in a hangar. I could see the metal. I understood that kind of aluminum. I could see, I was looking at the individuals that were their backs were on against the wall all the way around the hangar. They were security or military police. They had that kind of helmet on. They had sidearms. I was looking at their clothes. I was hitting myself. I could feel the metal gurney. Clearly, I was there. There was a gentleman who was an officer, and I figured him to be something like a psychiatric officer, because he was extremely concerned. He knew who I was. He knew what I'd been going through. He talked to me. He even referred to me as son, because he was probably 30 years older than I was, and he was apologetic about, at that time, what I was going through, and he said one day I would understand. There's a reason for what they're doing.
Wow.
I got upset during that particular experience because I saw a girl who was in one of those canisters, and I crossed the line. I was sitting on a gurney. I jumped up off the gurney, and I went across to something that was elevated by steps, almost like not a pedestal, but something they had raised to do this technical work, and I was trying to get her out of there, and that's when all this commotion took place. That's when the security that's up against the wall came running up. What made this thing ET was the fact that, so there was a lot of physical contact, so it wasn't something in your mind.
Sure.
And
sure.
It's, again, to make it simple, it's as conscious as you and I are speaking right now and as I'm seeing the coffee table in front of me. Yeah, it's hard physical stuff. And I did see one particular gray there, and I knew what was going on. What the gray was doing was they were working on a project, and this particular gray was not necessarily assisting or resisting. What I got out of this, they get technical gizmos, like let's say they want to transport people from point A to point B, molecularly speaking, and they're working on something like that. They'll bring these guys in there. Which they have agreements with them, and when I picked up on that, am I going into too much detail?
No, not at all. This really follows on.
Fascinating part.
I am almost finished with it, but the thought here, and the experience, but they bring these guys in there, not because these guys are leading the, when I say guys, these ETs, they're not leading the way as to how to construct these things. They're all, what I can see in aid, and I picked something up and I thought it was pretty cool, was that we're already working and developing on things, and from periodically, from time to time, they bring them in there to get assistance in the direction we're going. So I get the impression that the ETs aren't saying, no, you're not building it right, you've got the wrong concept, I suggest you do it like this. I got the impression that they aid in what we're already doing. So there seems to be some kind of a non-interference technically, but yet they aid in the directions that we're going, be it right or wrong.
Sure. So more as technical advisors rather than central to the program, as it were, or in charge, or, you know, it's very much said that either the entities are in charge or the military in charge, but you're not saying that at all. You seem to be saying there's some relationship that's not really based on power, in a sense.
Exactly. Now, let's bear in mind that there's many agendas, and I've learned that. So I happen to be caught up in the middle of one agenda as it was going on. Another thing fascinating about it, too, in that particular situation, I'm just talking about one scenario, and we're on the same page because you know that one, in the hangar, was this hangar appeared to be in the Nevada desert, because when the door opened and I saw the mountains when it was time to go, I just said Nevada. I just knew it was Nevada because I had been there and I live there now. But nonetheless, you could hear fighter jets taking off and landing and scrambling outside the hangar. So there was a thin wall, basically, as far as sound was concerned, and it was very intrusive and very loud, and I got the impression that they picked a spot somewhere. I don't want to say Area 51.
Sure,
I don't know that.
Okay,
common sense tells me it might be, but I'm not going to say that. However, they picked a hangar in an isolated area out there in the desert that's not where it's not occupied all the time, and you can see that this visitor must have came via ship, and they either shuttle them out to that particular hangar, which they don't normally use, but they had extra security, meaning that they had these jets scrambling over to the side, flying by the side of the hangar, over the hangar, because you can hear the sounds. And then, of course, they had these what looked like military police or security 20 feet apart from each other, all the way around the interior of this hangar. So I got the impression this guy was here for a short time. When I say guy, E.T., he was there, as you say, on a suggestive or advisory capacity in that particular project, and it was fast and it was going to be quick. And why I was there, I don't know. But I've been a part of this stuff for 19 years. And I was there, I was sitting on the gurney, and I got the impression that they had used some kind of new system to transport people from A to B, which we've been working on, and they had just transported me there, and they had me sitting on the gurney while they were working on other people getting there. So when I saw this girl in there, my instinct just told me there's danger here, and that's when I ran up there to try and pull her out.
Sure.
But so it looked like a temporary scenario for that particular project.
Yeah, I mean, all that's a fascinating area, and this links into one of the themes, Jim, that the exopolitics is about. Obviously, you know, the whole disclosure thing, and very much the amnesty thing that you've brought up. And Alfred Weber's done a lot on this and talking about the idea of amnesty and things. But I just thought, with regard to the military and the fact that you mentioned the prime directive of sort of non-intervention there and working with the military, Alfred made a suggestion that maybe this group of, and I think a lot of people will be interested in this, this group of ETs may well have overreached in some way, you may have a different view, because you described the way that you were told that there's been a technology exchange, and with this exotic technology that could have been put to, say, ecological use and various other uses, that in fact a lot of it was perhaps used nefariously or for weaponization. And I just wondered what you thought of that. Is it the idea, you think, that this has been planned all along, and they knew this, and perhaps in many developing worlds in our galaxy, That this same scenario goes on, that they have to deal with the power structures first? Or is it a case that you think that in some bizarre way they made a cosmic error in offering this technology to what are essentially are a military group who they knew, perhaps should have known full well what they do with it? I think a lot of people would have problems with that, and maybe you could explain your take on that situation.
Sure. I think what they did, as I reflect back over the years and interaction today, is they followed proper protocol. Meaning that I think they knew that it would end in not working, but no one could say they didn't follow proper protocol. What's proper protocol? You contact presidents, so to speak. I'm not saying presidents in these, per se. I'm just using that as a term to relate to. You contact power heads. You contact global leaders. you contact military, high military people that have a lot of power. You contact perhaps even what controls money, seen and unseen on this globe, to make a difference. And that's proper protocol. I think they knew it wouldn't work, but no one can say, hey, we didn't do the right thing first. From what I got out of that afterwards is the fact that they went through the motions of it. I think they figured it would turn out the way they did. So now they contact the average person, so to speak, and that's what I am, until it gets to a chain reaction point around the globe. I think now, see, you got to look at these guys, and I see things that are almost funny, but the way they think, they're extremely cunning.
Sure.
And
sure.
To give you an example, it's a little more than a theory on my part, but I'm going to go a little deeper than I just generally do. A lot of these crashes, for example, in the 40s and 50s, because I understand the way of thinking, was to promote a technology after the crash. In other words, you find a crash disk, and you're going to find things in there that are way ahead of what we got, correct?
Yeah.
And basically, we were, at those times in the 40s and such, we were still in vacuum tubes. And now you find integrated circuitry in a craft. Now you find fiber optics. Now you find quartz chips, and which is leaps and bounds from a vacuum tube, but it's not too far from one, where you can see it and back engineer it and understand it. I suspect in many cases, particularly in those early years, it was purposed, those crafts, to lead us to go in that direction, technically speaking, and keep us away from the real technology that they use, which is the ability to span the universe from point A to point B with no time passing, which is the ability of invisibility, which is the ability to travel dimensions, which is the ability to do all the marvelous, wondrous things they do, and keep us away from that technology, because I'm sure they knew we weren't ready. They tease us with where we're going once again, because it's interesting how we went basically from leaps and bounds from a vacuum tube to a chip and all those marvelous things that there seemed to be an overnight change. Mm-hmm. And I strongly suspect, more than theory, that they were working us that way. I think even some of the beams that were retrieved in crashes, I'm not going to say all of them, but some of them were biologically engineered from part of genetically from them, genetically from us, to even create what would appear to be an alien, if I'm making sense to you,
yeah.
To, again, steer us in a different technical direction.
Well, with just regard to what you said in that case about, do you, the way you see it then, you mentioned that time travel technology perhaps has been passed on and is now sort of run-of-the-mill stuff. So we're essentially saying that this stuff's been passed into, because if you imagine handing on something like time travel technologies to military or to human race in its current condition, is it a lot more complex than I'm seeing it, the fact that you're passing on something like that where you can fundamentally alter the world? Obviously, you can alter the world in which we live, so... It's says,
difficult to do. Sure. I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Go ahead, sir.
No, I'm just saying that obviously with that sort of technology, you need a great deal of responsibility. So it says that to some extent, there must be a degree of responsibility, whatever that is, in these circles. And I just wondered what you thought about that, passing something on such as that.
Absolutely, and I'm glad you touched on that. When you look at the galactic neighborhood, just the simple thing of being telepathic, that means that even if you're a different species and you don't really agree with what the other group is doing or species of ETs are doing, the fact that it's that what is agreed is that the ability of telepathy or to be telepathic is that you always know, quote unquote, what your enemy is thinking. There could never be surprise attacks out there in the cosmos. So so it's a total consciousness of what everyone's doing out there, but yet you have your own and separate agenda, and then evolved species, evolved races don't war. They don't need to. They get out of the way of whatever agenda someone else is doing, and all those factors that we have to deal with, like greed and fighting and things of that nature, are overcome. As far as the responsibility of time travel, what I find interesting is that what I've learned over the years, and I'm learning more as I go, it's that it's the opposite of the butterfly effect, meaning that the butterfly effect, and I'm not going to quote it exactly, means that if you alter just a small thing, it can make humongous changes in the future. It couldn't be any more the reverse. If you could look at time like a river, let's say that's 100 meters across. Let's say it's 80 feet deep. Let's say 80 to 100 feet deep, very deep. Let's say that it's traveling along at 20 or 30 knots, or, you know, 25, 30 miles an hour. There's a massive amount of power, and there's a massive amount of water flowing through there. You're standing at the bank as this river is rushing by, and it almost takes your breath away because you can sense the power of it. That's something natural. That's a time. In order to alter that river, you can only do it as a person in a very minimal way, meaning that, let's say you're a time traveler and you want to change the future. Well, there's not much you can do. You can take your hand, and you can walk to the edge of the river, stoop down, stick your hand in the water, and that water is going to rush just a few inches. It's going to rush by your hand, and then it's going to rush around it, and then it's going to continue where it was going. So time is resilient. It resists change. It takes just the opposite, a tremendous, horrendous amount of energy to change a future event. It's very, very difficult. Fortunately, nature dictates that time is resilient. It's like a rubber band. It wants to bounce right back to where it was. Not to say it cannot be manipulated, but it takes the cooperation of a lot of different entities, a lot of different groups, a lot of different species, organized, focused on primarily wanting to change a future thing, and it takes a horrendous amount of energy to do. So fortunately, when we do travel time, it will take, it's pretty hard to mess up.
Sure. And I think, like you say, that the universe and the cosmos, in a certain way, does have a wonderful way of balancing these things out. So if there's any little tinkering that goes on, then the cosmos steps in and this balance is again restored. And I think the analogy you used there with the river was excellent, and will help a lot of people visualize that.
I'd just like to concur with that it's a really great analogy, very different way of looking at it, because I think for the last 100 years we've all been fed the myth that, you know, if time travel exists, then you go back in time and the whole world will change into another...
The paradox. You know, the paradox.
And as you say, the deep structures of time and space mean that paradox doesn't actually take place, which is, of course, how that would be, but it's just great to hear it in that sense.
I can give you a personal example of how I experienced it, if you would like.
Yeah, please do.
Only one time, clearly, I was placed... I got abducted. And I write about this in much more detail, but I got for time's sake, I got abducted. The abduction took approximately 2 hours, and then I was brought back like I normally would be brought back, anybody that's abducted, but of course in my case I'm 95% conscious throughout the whole thing. But when I was brought back home, I was brought back home 2 to 3 minutes before I left. Now, I thought at that time that was some technological error. But what was interesting was, and I saw how a little bit again about time travel and its effects. I was on the sofa, I was watching TV, before I got pulled, I got up to get a snack out of the refrigerator, and I had to walk around an island kitchen, I stopped to look at my fish in the aquarium, I opened the refrigerator door, tinkered around with some stuff in there, drank a soda, took a bite of a sandwich, shut the door, and walked back to the sofa, and then I got pulled, or I got abducted. When they brought me back, and I was back on that same sofa, immediately I saw the back of myself standing up in the living room, and it just, like, my heart just, like, almost stopped. And I saw myself walking towards the kitchen, and I saw myself looking at the fish. And I was laying there on the sofa, dead silent. I didn't even want to breathe. I didn't even want to disturb, because I thought, my God, they got me here before I even left, and I'm watching myself. And physically, as hard as this table is, that was me. I walked into the kitchen as I did before. I opened up the refrigerator. I saw the light go on in the refrigerator. I heard me tinkering around in the refrigerator, eating the sandwich, drinking the soda, shutting the door. As I started back towards myself, going to the sofa, is when I got extremely scared, because I knew at that moment, what would me do once me realizes that I'm there? Me is seeing me, okay? And I was in tremendous fear. And as I walked around and that other me looked in my direction to go onto the sofa where I was, remember now, I was 2 or 3 minutes ahead of the back time, so it was time was falling back into place, that person did not see me. And as that person walked towards me to get onto the sofa, when that other me was about approximately 5-6 feet away, it faded away, and as it disappeared. So I started seeing through that other person, and then as that person got within a few feet of me, it disappeared. It faded away. So I'm seeing something that the thing about you occupying the same space at the same time with your other self, there's something to do time, dimension, split in dimensions, concepts that we don't understand yet, but what I'm seeing is one obviously cannot interfere with the other, but yet one can be there. So that's just one little splice of what I understand time travel to be. So again, it goes back to that premise that it's not to say it can't be done and not to say the technology doesn't exist to change the future, but you really have to go out of your way to do it.
Sure. In a couple of words, Jim, just I'm interested in this, but do you think that when you were put back, as you said, a little bit ahead, do you think that was done on purpose for that exact reason? Do you think there are no accidents in this, or do you think that was a little slip-up, just out of interest?
At the time, for many years, I perceived it as a slip-up, and I never commented it or asked them about it. I just kept it to myself, because the thing I've learned about these guys is that they'll tell you something when they want you to know it.
Sure.
And you can ask things until you're blue in the face and you're not going to get anywhere, unless it's a particular occasion where you did well in their eyes and then you get to ask a question. But this one I kept to myself, and I was convinced, but not solidly convinced, over those early years that it was a slip up. As time has gone on and I'm seeing an agenda and I'm seeing a plan globally, I realize now that what I got to experience is something that I can share with people so they can start to get a feel of really what time travel is, just the way that this interview is going. You happen to go into that depth, and I'm very appreciative of it. These are things that I enjoy. Instead of, it's nothing wrong with you ask me what does their face look like, but that's pretty common, and I don't mind answering it, but I like to go into this depth. And I get a good sense, and I think it'll prove itself out because I always give it time, that it's so I can talk like I'm talking to you, or others that are like me can say, well, hey, let me tell you a little bit about time in a very nice and gentle way. It's hard to change, and you're not gonna go back there and shoot your grandfather and not be born, like the paradox says.
Sure, and it's interesting, isn't it, that these stories, as they seem, that can act like, almost like a virus, so that when people are retelling your story and discussing it online or in person or on radio, then these things obviously act as sort of an attractor to people. These little episodes that you tell, as you say, they give away so much more. You're telling what appears to be a story, but then these are things that people remember and latch onto, and I think that's, like you say, there's some purpose behind that.
There is, I believe there is, sir.
Paul, have you got another one?
Yeah, yes, I mean, it really relates to what you were talking about earlier about the human-alien kind of joint program that, you know, I've read The Keepers a few times now, and throughout the book, there seems to be this whole thread of human involvement throughout it. You know, at the beginning you talk about the men in black hanging around in the sedans, and you know, and threatening you and your family, which was really interesting. And then the black helicopter zoning in on you after an abduction, and then the reptoid speech about that. Basically, they disclosed that there was a program and that there was a technology transfer, and then the airbase. And throughout it must have been a real shock when it hit you, the levels of human involvement, the fact that we've been systematically lied to for the past 60 years at least, and
oh,
maybe
God,
more.
Yes. Oh, God, yes. Did you finish the comment?
Yeah. I'd just like your take on that.
I still have that deep, deep, deep resentment within me of not letting the card fall as they may, and exposing the truth, because the human species is resilient. The stock market's not going to crash. People who are religious, they're going to believe what they're going to believe anyway. It won't disrupt the government, but see, if things were laid on the table and the cards, if the truth cards, so to speak, were played, let's say 60 years ago, sure, it would have been, it would have changed our understanding of ourselves and in relationship to the cosmos like it had never probably done in the course of human history. And then we would have gotten over that shock, and then we would start asking other questions like, how do we get from point A to point B? Or how do we travel time? Or what is it that the human species is capable of? We haven't evolved yet, and one of the major problems with evolving to would be extension of your lifespan, because unfortunately about the time we figure things out, if we live to be 75 or 80, we're lucky, it's about time to die.
Yes.
And that's the reason for the amnesty thing. It'll bring out technology so you go on in health for thousands of years, if not literally forever. I hate to step on religious toes when I say these things. The technology to derive our energy needs without hurting the planet whatsoever, non-polluting, free energy. The technology to go from point A to point B with literally no time passing. The technology exists, and I know that it does. It's in human hands. That's the reason for the amnesty, meaning that these people have to have an avenue to come out where they can't be prosecuted, they can't be convicted, and equally as important, their peers can't touch them. There is a growing majority, in my experience, in black ops. There's a growing majority in agencies sanctioned and not sanctioned, secret governments, call it whatever you want. There's a growing majority that realizes that they want to get this stuff out, and there's no avenue. Now, once these things are out, then the face of the planet as we see it will not be the same. For the first time in human history, we can evolve. And we can evolve to the point of joining the galactic neighborhood. But that avenue has to be created first.
Sure.
Yes. I mean, could I just finally ask on that? And it's something that, you know, on the internet, it's talked about a lot, that the fact that they are withholding this technology and all that goes with it. Is this a human decision, you think, at the base? Or
absolutely.
As someone, because it's interesting that some people in this field talk about an alien dimension, the malevolent aliens who are somehow withholding this technology or changing timelines. You don't think that's the case. It's simply about power and control and the usual greed and monkey business that goes on this planet. That's what's
correct.
Holding
correct.
It up. Excellent.
There's a solution, though, sir. There's a solution.
Of course there is.
Okay. The reason I know that there's a humans possess it, because I've seen humans and ETs so many times together in these experiences that I've lost count, and they're together. So now you have people who are working with this technology. So what does it tell you? I'm not pulling it out of a hat, so to speak, and I'm not philosophizing. I'm going by what I've seen face to face. I've seen military. I've seen I think civilian, because they're in lab coats, and I don't think they're connected with the military individuals. I've seen all types of human beings interacting with ETs using this technology, and so it tells me, and it tells all of us, that human beings possess it. I think years ago it was proper protocol to hand down technology that you discovered in black ops to the general public 20 years after the fact. Are you with me on that?
Yes, sure. Absolutely.
Meaning, let's take the space race. It's an example. Solid-state circuitry was in its infancy, and the way we worked with computers in those days was in its infancy, but it was kept from us, and then years later they felt comfortable and then released it to the public. There's no secret in that we got so much out of the space race and so forth. But the problem now is that technology leaps are not just 20 years ahead anymore. They're hundreds of years ahead. Things that the imagination can only fathom that could possibly exist, and they do. So the gap is so humongous. So there is another responsibility out there. It's not so much greed in this case or they're being devious. It's the fact that when you've got something that's hundreds of years ahead, it's kind of dangerous, and in their eyes, okay? I'm
sure.
Not saying I agree with this, okay? Just to throw it out there to the public. And so there's a lot of responsibility in that respect. As far as the greed factor is concerned, a suggestion by these higher thinking minds, and I'm just going to throw something out there to give you a sample without going into a lot of detail, and I'll make up a name. Let's say there's a major oil company called Coron. I'll just say Coron.
Okay.
I'll make something up. Coron has, there's no incentive on the part of Coron to have any new energy technologies, because what's the first thing that's going to come into their minds? We're going to lose
money. Profit, obviously.
Yeah, and lots of it, right?
Yeah, lots.
Okay, so here's the suggestion on their part to take care of that greed example. One thing about this life, and one thing about business in this life, is that there are no guarantees that you will still be in business from 1 year to the next, correct?
Sure.
Okay, true.
Now, all right, so let's say a deal is worked out with Coron that we guarantee you the energy profits, even though this is free energy and it's simple, for 20 years or 30 years. And then after 20 or 30 years, you have to start releasing 5-10% of your control of this free energy to the globe in general. So where you have full control, so to speak, not total, where they can, you know, take it from us, mm-hmm. for 20 or 30 years, make all the profits that you can stand, have a regulatory commission to make certain that they don't go overboard with it, but it's theirs, so don't take from them. Give that to them, so to speak. Now it's theirs, and guarantee them, the global population, guarantee them, you control the profits, it's your baby for 20 to 30 years. Now let's say we say 30. Let's look long-term here, because now we're living longer, because now we have technology through amnesty that extends our lives, so what's 30 years? Big deal. And they're guaranteed that profit, and maybe even much more than they ever imagined. It's not hurting the earth. They're making their money. After 30 years, they start relinquishing 5 or 10% of that control to this regulatory global commission, where the people, by the end of 50 years, have full control of that energy. Now, what you did for them was gave them one or two generations of families that will be guaranteed their wealth. They can plan their future with this money, knowing that in 20 or 30 years they will be in business and doubling their profit as they go. We're not hurting the planet in the meantime. And then the people, of course, are benefiting. Now, what I see happening when the human species evolves and joins the galactic neighborhood, no one's really going to care about a lot of the things that we have to in this world, because it's our nature to kill, because we eat animals, we eat flesh. It's our nature to take the resources from the planet for shelter. It's our nature to be extremely protective of our siblings and our young, which puts us in a competition all the time. So you can be the kindest, most gentlest, most wonderful individuals filled with spirit in this world, yet you still have to eat, yet you still need shelter, yet you're still taking from the planet, even though you follow my point.
Yes.
We will evolve to the point where those things are taken care of and we can move on to other things like what is in the galactic neighborhood. But that's just one suggestion that I've gotten from these abduction experiences here in the last couple of years on how to handle one of the that greed aspect.
Sure, and Jim, that's a great model to go along with the whole disclosure and the amnesty thing. I think that's a really useful way of seeing it as people with stakeholders and things like that. And I realize we're pushed for time. Just two more minutes, if you could just spare it for.
Thank you for realizing that. And sure, 2 minutes would be fine. I do have another appointment, but that'll work within the scope of my appointment. Two minutes.
That's great. Well, I mean, this links into. I just wanted to know just briefly how. You mentioned you had the episode where you were, I think, a waiter in a certain establishment, and one of the keepers, an entity came in, and also the episode with the painter when you were at a conference. And it just seems that I just wondered for book two, which I understand you're writing now. How has the whole experience for you changing, and where does it look like it's going at the moment? If you could just sum that up with regard to book two, and then we'll close at that.
Sure. And remember, I don't want to sound like a commercial artist here, but there's more detail in book one, which you can get through jim-sparks.com. Also, the interaction with these beings in these last few years has evolved to what I call and consider something extremely wonderful. Nothing's 100% predictable yet. When they pull this individual, meaning me, it's on their timetable, but the interactions are wonderful, meaning that instead of me being sitting in my living room or laying on my bed or in my car driving and getting pulled in the middle of the day or the night, a gut-wrenching experience and finding myself on board and not knowing what's going on, it's evolved to them informing me. And it's taken this many years, and it just happened with anybody. It's evolved into them informing me where to go, who to meet, where to meet them. And I'm very, very sensitive about that. So when I go to these places that they plan out for me to show and then to meet me, I keep tight-lipped The interaction takes place, and I purposely wait several months, in some cases a year or so, before I'll even talk about it publicly, because I let the trail run cold.
Yes.
Because you do have ambitious researchers who would probably realize that, hey, it might be worth watching this guy 24 hours a day if we can see something happen. So I make sure the trail runs cold in that respect. Interaction-wise, I've learned over the years that I've gotten to see things in those early years. They would present holograms constantly out of order of the future. I saw a board that had the chairman of the board in the minutes that would be for the rainforest, where the people actually, where we possess and buy the rainforest.
That might be for another segment.
And there is a way to do this. I just saw something that I knew. The Ecuadorian president, I can't remember his name, I apologize, but he has offered 1 million acres of, and I know this is evolved thinking suggesting this to this man, it struck right home. He's offered a little more than 1 million, I think it's called a hectare, or 1 million acres of rainforest land that has a giant oil reserve under it. And he has offered to the global community it's worth about $30 billion in oil, that he would preserve it and stop it from being developed if the global community will give the money resources to that country, and then it's sensitive area, then he would not develop it. Now, this is something that that has been told to me over the years, and this is the things I'm writing about in the second book. I'm writing about recent interactions and where it's going globally and so forth, and how to get ourselves in the galactic neighborhood. And when I read that article, and this was just a couple of days ago, it was sent to me via email, it just struck me as, hey, I'm seeing a chain reaction here. I'm seeing critical mass. I'm seeing a world leader, the president of that country. Obviously, something was in his ear to say what they've been telling me, and I'm sure others that will eventually come out, possess the property. That gives you owner's rights. Possess that property, possess the rainforest, keep the Indians in the rainforest that are indigenous to that property. You got to be concerned, the global community, and this is coming from them, not coming from Jim, the global community needs to have be very concerned about the individuals who are thrashing and burning, because they're destroying that rainforest land for inadequate housing and non-knowledge of crop rotation.
Yes.
So for their efforts to restore the rainforest and their labors and doing the opposite, which is to restore, they get a plot of land with a decent house for their family, and they also learn how to do the crops. And so as they involve themselves more in restoring, they get a better plot. But one of the first steps is controlling, and that's through purchase. And I'd like to kind of end it on this note, which kind of fascinated me. The man is saying that it claims that it's going to be a, but don't take quote me, because this is something that in what he quoted, and who knows what it is in the bottom line, but the ET say double the offer, triple the offer. Make it no mistake what your intentions
Wonderful.
Are. It's not to gain a profit, it's to save the globe. But I thought about how really $30 billion, U.S. dollars, okay, in this case, sounds like so much, but when you think about it, there's 300 million Americans in the United States. I'm just going to use my country because I know how many there are. And if you divide it out, I think that comes out to something like $100 a person.
Sure. Which is nothing.
That's not very much money. No, it's not. And then, of course, if you have free world governments involved in buying this stuff, and we need to stop it now, and see, that's what those guys are nudging. They're saying, clean up your backyard. Now, the main reason for cleaning up your backyard is obvious, the environment, but one of the driving force behind it is if the global community, meaning the whole world, has a hands-on project. The rainforest is something that we can see. We can see it recede, and we can see it progress. You can physically see this with your eyes. If, for the first time in history, everybody on this planet, so to speak, who wants to be involved, of course, contributes into purchasing all the equatorial rainforest property around the globe and brings it back with some of the steps that I've just outlined, for the first time in our history, we would have done something together, and we can see it come back. That pulls in the best people and the best professionals that this planet and resources that this planet has to offer. That will pull in freely some of the best minds that are out there of the 6 billion people, And once we accomplish something like that in their eyes and we see it and we go, we finally did it, then we can take on all these other challenges because now we've developed an organization on a global basis that can look at the pollution of the sky, that can look at the pollution of the sea. At the same time, and this is in the eyes of the this interaction, we have amnesty. So while we're working for ourselves on the rainforest, amnesty is out, and it's an avenue from these people who possess this technology to bring forth things like, hey, I've got something here that can restore the rainforest and help you by 100%, leaps and bounds. Another one comes out and says, hey, I've got something here that can restore the sea, and so on and so on.
Sure. Sure, and it's interesting, Jim, isn't it, that how often change in this world has been made by often a handful of people. It's interesting with Ecuador. I know a little bit about what's going on there, that it's just a small country, but again, vast changes can come from just one person like the president and a community there making these subtle changes, and huge effects can come from that.
Create an evolutionary bootstrap.
I got a vague article on the Ecuador thing. It was only two paragraphs. It wasn't in great detail. I hope I didn't stick my foot out and not knowing the exacting details, but I got a vague article sent to me. But the point is, the thinking is in the right direction there's no doubt.
Sure, I know. Yeah. I mean, and that was interesting to hear.
Very interesting.
Thank you, I appreciate that. On the ecological note, I just wondered if you could find out, if you know anything, have you heard of the chemtrails phenomena? This is to do with the ecology and what's happening in our skies to do with aeroplane trails. Have you heard anything about that?
Well, I suspect a lot. And that's an area that I may talk in private and perhaps write about briefly, because I think what I believe to know about it is it would just cause more problems than it's worth.
Okay.
I can say something that I think what's behind it ain't as ominous as perhaps we think, but again, that's an area that I think that'll work itself out, and I'm going to stay away from that.
All right.
Okay. No, fair enough.
Okay, Jim, thank you very much for taking the time out to talk to us today on Cosmic Trigger Radio for Exopolitics UK. If anyone is interested in reading Jim's book, you can actually go and get it direct from his new website that's online. He'd prefer you to do that than and support him than actually go to other places like Amazon. So his website address is jimsparks.com.
So Jim Dash, you got to get the dash.
Sorry.
I tried to get the name Jim Sparks, but it was taken. So.
That's outrageous, Jim.
time for a lawsuit to get it back.
Yeah, who would do such a thing?
Yeah, I know.
But no, a real pleasure to speak to you, Jim.
Yeah, I
thank you.
Yeah, I hope we can do it again sometime. And I would
love to.
Thanks to Eileen for sorting this out. And have a good day. We'll speak to you again soon, hopefully.
I want to compliment you gentlemen on the depth in which you reached with me, and I love to come out in this depth. And yes, I would love to come back one day.
Well, hopefully as well, we'll see you in the UK. We're doing a conference in 2008, logistics and various things that are in the planning at the moment. Then I'd love to get you over here to speak. So we'll work on that. But thank you for your time today.
Oh, please do. I would love to run over there and speak in the UK. That would be great.
Yeah,
if you would work on that, that'd be wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Thanks for your time, Jim. Cheers.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.